On this week's 51%, there was a time when violet corsages were in. Even a first lady was known to sport them.
Marie Louise were the kind that were grown here. They were a rather large violet.
And the National Guard steps in to plug staff shortages at long-term care facilities in California. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%.
Quand Margot dégrafait son corsage pour donner la gougoute à son chat, tous les gars du village étaient là la 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 la, étaient là la 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 la, et Margot qui était simple et
très sage. You've heard of the Rust Belt, the Corn Belt, the Sun Belt, but what about the Violet Belt? The Violet Belt ran through a portion of New York's Dutchess County in the Hudson Valley. Recently, a ceremony in the heart of what used to be the Violet Belt commemorated the town as the Violet Capital of the World. Rhinebeck Town Supervisor Elizabeth Spinzia lifted off the white sheet emblazoned with violets to reveal an historical marker.
One of our wonderful residents, Norm Magnuson, came up with a great idea to commemorate Rhinebeck's past as the Violet Capital of the World with a Pomeroy Foundation sign. And, you know, it's just a good example of how local government works. You know, a partnership with residents and elected officials and appointed officials and local non-for-profits.
The marker, with a few violets planted at the foot, sits on Route 9G at the entrance to Drayton Grant Park at Burger Hill. Magnuson thought the site made sense.
This 9G used to be known as Violet Avenue. And still down in Hyde Park, there are road signs that call it Violet Avenue. And back in the day, Hyde Park, Rhinebeck, and Red Hook were called the Violet Belt. And they said that Rhinebeck was the buckle on the belt.
Carl Meyer is president of the Winnicke Land Trust, which owns and maintains the park.
He approached us and said, you know, the Burger Hill is a public space. People come here all the while. They come to walk up and down the hill. It'd be a great place to display this particular sign, this historical marker, which recognizes, you know, Rhinebeck's history as a violet. And it just so happens we're right next to Violet Hill Road. So, and there were violet farms close by here, so it's just kind of a natural location for it. And a lot of people will see it, even if they don't come to Burger Hill, the heavy traffic on 9G, we'll see it.
The marker has the title Violet Capital and reads, by 1894, Rhinebeck grew and shipped millions of violets weekly for corsages and gifts. By 1928, town called Violet Capital of the World. Michael Fraser is Rhinebeck deputy town historian.
George Saltford, who moved in a little bit before 1890 to Violet Hill Road and set up his violet growing practice there, also wrote a book, How to Make Money Growing Violets. And it was a bestseller in this area, at least, and bought by quite a few locals, not just here, but in Hyde Park, Red Hook, Poughkeepsie, where the soil was just right for growing the particular kind of violets that he was promoting. And the enterprise of growing violets just took off. And it was in the middle of the village of Rhinebeck that you transported your mature violets. They had to be picked in the dark so they wouldn't open up. They were put in these wooden boxes and taken to the Railway Express Agency on East Market Street, the village of Rhinebeck. Today it's a pizza business. And from there, once that horse-drawn wagon, an enormous one, was full from these contributions of boxes from local farmers, it was taken down to the railroad station, in Rhinecliff, and within a couple hours it was in New York City. And they sold very well. And as more and more people set up their own greenhouses in the way that he talked about doing it in this book that he wrote, it became a very popular business.
So this was $1 million a year to the town of Rhinebeck?
In 1907, according to the county records, the amount of revenue was $1 million from violet growing in the town of Rhinebeck. Yes, that's right.
According to the history, the violet business dried up for two reasons. Magnuson explains.
And one was the change in fashions. Violets were extremely popular, as the sign mentions, on corsages. And when the flapper era came in, women's dresses had straps and they just couldn't support the weight of corsage.
Then a play was the thing, a French play in 1926 performed in New York City called The Captive.
There was a play starring Basil Rathbone, who later went on to play Sherlock Holmes, I think. And the play was about him and his wife's female lover. And his wife and her lover exchanged violets as a symbol of their forbidden love. Now, the play was closed down after like 6 weeks or something on Broadway. The cops swooped in. They were like, no, 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 you can't have a play about that stuff in this day and age. It was 1920-something. And so the play closed down. But the idea of violets as a symbolic gift between gay women maintained.
Roses are red, my love. Violets are blue.
Magnuson talks about how the idea sprouted.
You know, I live on South Street in the Village. My friend Chris, who also lives on South Street, said, you know, across the street from me, this was all greenhouses. I was like, what? And he told me a little bit, he's from around here, he told me a little of the history of the violet trade in Rhinebeck. And then about a month later, somebody sent me a link to the William G. Pomeroy Foundation call for proposals to get historical markers funded. And New York State stopped in like 1939 or something funding historical markers, and the Pomeroy Foundation picked that up. And so I went through the process of researching, and the town historians you spoke to were really helpful. And then I took it to the town board and I pitched it to Elizabeth Spinzia, who we spoke with, and she said, great idea, make it happen. And so I did.
Fraser says the violet belt was known for a certain variety.
Marie Louise were the kind that were grown here. They were a rather large violet, and it's the kind that Eleanor Roosevelt is seen displaying.
Hyde Park, home of FDR and Eleanor Roosevelt, is just south of Rhinebeck on the old violet belt.
So I don't know if anybody's willing to try to do those again, but Battenfeld's does continue to raise and make them available for those who want to buy them out in Rock City, but it is a lot of work. They are a very sensitive flower to raise some seed.
He says once there were 116 growers in town. Today, Battenfeld's and Red Hook is the only major commercial grower of violets remaining in the region. And now Battenfeld's is the world's leading wholesale grower of anemones. Members of the National Guard have been deployed across the country to assist overwhelmed health departments deal with COVID-19. In California, one of the hardest hit states, Guardspeople also are working a non-traditional mission in long-term care facilities. Emily Elena Dugdale reports for the American Homefront Project.
The headlines from California haven't been good. More than 6 months into the COVID-19 pandemic, the state now has the most cases in the country. California National Guard soldiers are stationed in nursing homes across the state, doing everything from taking care of both residents' daily and medical needs to rearranging furniture and disinfecting facilities hit hard by the virus. Over 200 medical personnel have responded. They've been in 25 nursing homes, 2 hospitals, and 2 other medical centers since the virus hit the Golden State.
It's unexpected. A bunch of people get exposed. And then they call the state and say, hey, we need help.
Colonel James Ward is the joint surgeon for the state National Guard. He says the teams deployed at skilled nursing facilities are called rapid medical strike teams with around 8 to 10 people.
Medical doctors, physician assistants, physical therapists, respiratory therapists, even behavioral health, and a bunch of field medics.
Early on in the pandemic, they had as many as 13 teams spread across the state as healthcare facilities scrambled to staff up against the virus. Now, as staffing demands have eased, it's down to 5. Ward says in general, these strike teams stay at a location for 72 hours to 6 days to get them over the staffing crunch.
Once they're stable and they're good to go, we literally reset and we wait for the next mission.
Captain Serenity Holden oversees a team that runs mobile COVID-19 testing centers across the state. These mobile teams have done around 20,000 tests so far. I reach Holden at the hotel where she and her team isolate themselves when not on duty. They've been hotel living since the beginning of May.
I was definitely not expecting this to be a long-term assignment.
And no one did. But now Holden is stationed in Sacramento County, operating a high-demand drive-through testing site.
There's been lines before we got there, and we hit our maximum capacity within 2 hours.
Her team also set up pop-up testing sites at more than 40 nursing homes.
They have been so locked away from everyone so that everyone seems so very happy to get some interaction with people.
But she says not everyone is happy to see soldiers in uniform on their streets and in their nursing homes.
We've had some people say we're a little worried about, are you guys going to show up in tanks? Are you going to show up with guns?
Holden says her team of soldiers who swab people for the virus try to be less intimidating. Their uniforms, for example,
they're basically pajamas. We don't have a bunch of guns.
But they do have a lot of personal protective gear.
N95 masks, face shields, gowns, the whole nine.
The Department of Defense says over 3,000 National Guard soldiers across the country have tested positive for COVID-19. In California, Colonel James Ward says they've had better luck.
It's not been a excessive amount any different from what's going on in the community. We monitor that closely.
But the virus shows few signs of slowing down here. Just recently, California, for the first time, hit more than 150 COVID-19 deaths in a single day. In Los Angeles, I'm Emily Elena Dugdale.
This story was produced by the American Homefront Project, a public media collaboration that reports on American military life and veterans. Living life as a multi-ethnic person in the entertainment industry can have its challenges. But one performer has found a way to choose joy, despite others trying to put her in boxes. Diana Apong Perry brings us this audio portrait.
I have realized, maybe over the past year or two, that I despise being put in boxes. I think I always knew this, but I have felt more freedom as of late saying it. My name is Sianna Palantonio, but everyone calls me Sai. I live in Seattle. And I am a director, choreographer, performer. I am also a mother and a wife and all around joy maker.
Do the pop pop boogie.
Do the pop pop boogie.
Wow.
Shake it, move it.
Shake it, move it.
Shake it, move it.
I think I always knew I was going to be a performer ever since I was little. And there have been times in my life when I've been afraid to admit that's what I wanted. I still struggle with that. But I saw my first movie musical on TV when I was 7 years old. It's a film called Top Hat. It stars Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers. And it changed my life. I fell in love with that style of dancing, that kind of quirky humor, the way dance can just be so fun, it can be elegant, it can be character-driven. It's what I've wanted to do my whole life. I grew up in and around Washington, D.C., and growing up there, it was incredible, and I say that because of the cultural diversity. I was always surrounded by many cultures, many races. And I also was so lucky to grow up in a place where we had the Smithsonian Museums, which are free and open to the public. So there was always an opportunity for higher education and learning. My ethnic background is a big old beautiful mix of various cultures. I am Chinese, Algonquin Native American, Welsh, and African American. I love, love, love my mix. My father, he was originally from Chattanooga, Tennessee, and my mom's family is from Hong Kong. She was born and raised there, and she came to the U.S. alone when she was 17 to go to nursing school in Salisbury, Maryland, and that's where she met my father. Growing up with an immigrant mother, she was always hyper-focused on assimilating to American culture, looking and acting very quote-unquote American, whatever that meant to her at the time in, you know, the 70s and the 80s. And so she didn't share much of her Chinese culture with us growing up. I was fortunate enough to learn a little bit of Cantonese from her when I was little, But as she was trying to make strides in the medical field, it was very important for her to try to look and act as American as possible. I think she feels pretty bad about that now. She's often said to me, I wish I kept up with teaching you Cantonese. And she's making a concerted effort to teach Luca Cantonese whenever she can and to share certain traditions that she wished she taught her children. The only traditions that have been passed down to me and now that I am passing on to my son and my family is the celebration of Chinese New Year. Which is a pretty good tradition. And we celebrate by going out to have dim sum, watching the lion dance, and giving Lacey Daloy, which is lucky money. It's maybe a 20 in a red envelope. We give that out to younger kiddos, and our son loves that. I got into my career at the age of 10. A local summer stock theater was doing a production of Oklahoma, and they needed two kids. And I was lucky enough to be one of those kids. And so every summer I went back and auditioned, and I just grew up doing these shows, 1 to 2 musicals every single summer until I was 20. I went to university for music theater. So I majored in that, and the combination of going to school for that and doing these summer stock shows, I was able to network and meet people and get myself out there and be asked to audition for professional theaters around the DMV. And for those who don't know what the DMV is, it means DC, Maryland, and Virginia. and I was able to do theater, industrials, commercials, extra work, which then led me to New York and Philly, where I continue to perform in theater and independent film, but then I also added director and tour dancer to my resume. My favorite gig was being a garage girl, a go-go dancer. Wow! This job came to me out of nowhere. I was living in DC and I saw on Craigslist that this band was coming to town and that there were two dancers from New York, but they needed one local girl. And I submitted my headshot and resume. They didn't even meet with me in person. I had a phone call with a woman named Maureen Van Zandt, and I had no idea she was the wife of the incredible Steven Van Zandt, otherwise known as Little Steven, Bruce Springsteen's guitarist, and the head of the Underground Garage, which is a Sirius satellite radio show and a record label. I got hired based on this phone interview and pictures I submitted. I did that one gig in DC, and she asked me to be a part of the group, the Garage Girls of Go-Go, which was the dance company for Little Steven's Underground Garage. And through there, I was able to tour the country dancing with these really awesome bands. I've been in music videos, at concerts, I've been on VH1. So many cool opportunities. And I think I did that for about 3 to 4 years. I have been in so many different casting situations and in everyday conversations where inevitably the subject of my race comes up. And for some reason, people desperately want to know. And I'm not ashamed. I am so proud of all the things that make up me, but I just don't want it to define me. You know, I try not to inject what I am into everyday conversation or to make that part of my professional branding because I just want to be seen as me. There have been a few instances of offensiveness and racism when I've gone to castings. And, you know, people are a lot more careful about this now, but I, you know, just as short as 10 years ago, people felt like they could say anything to you. I have been told that, you know, I'm just enough white to make it right. I have been told that I don't look Asian enough. You know, there have been so many instances. I've always believed in speaking up. I try to change the game with positivity instead of focusing on that negative, which I could so easily do. I try to change the conversation and just have people see me for me so that they can start seeing all individuals as just that, individuals.
Dad, you pick the right time.
I do. My life before COVID-19 was actually pretty hectic and busy. In addition to taking care of Luca, you know, with school and with play dates and dance classes, I was constantly auditioning, teaching, or rehearsing.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
Just really hitting the pavement always. You can't ever stop in my business. You know, there's no time to really like reset and breathe. You just have to keep going. And so when I wasn't doing any of that, I was trying to take care of my body and my soul by doing Pilates, walking. I especially love walking around Green Lake, or drinking coffee with friends in all my favorite cafes. I really miss that. My life now is obviously very different, as is everyone's. I've lost a whole year of work, but I'm still keeping busy. You know, I thrive off of being busy, especially with artistic work. I'm teaching virtual dance and acting lessons. I do one-on-ones, and that's a way of, you know, giving encouragement to others and staying driven. I'm taking virtual dance classes myself because I just love continuing my training. I think you're never too old to keep learning and to keep training. I'm teaching myself electric guitar. My favorite thing that I have learned to teach myself on the electric guitar has been a Green Day song, The Jesus of Suburbia. And it's like an 8-minute song. I love the musical American Idiot. I love all sorts of music, all sorts. But like Green Day was a big coming of age band for me when I was, 11. I love rocking out to the Jesus of Suburbia. You scream sing it, you know, like 16 times. It feels good to sometimes just like scream sing I don't care and just jam, you know, on the electric guitar. When I'm feeling down, I turn to my husband. He is my rock and my soft space. He doesn't try to fix things, but he listens and he understands what I'm going through, like having lost all my work, being a person of color, being a woman who has always kind of felt uncomfortable with being called a woman. He supports all of that and he supports me. In terms of performing, I really dislike how, you know, being perceived as a woman, I'm supposed to look a certain way, dance a certain way, be talked to a certain way. I just really despise that. So I'm trying to change the game there so that, you know, not only for my own comfort, but so that, you know, my son, he can grow up seeing that a woman and a mother can look like many different things. It all ties back to having been put in a box all my life due to my ethnic background. I don't like being put in a box due to my race, and I definitely don't like being put in a box because of my perceived gender. You know, I am anatomically a woman. My pronouns, I've been switching it up. I've been using they, them, theirs lately, and it makes me feel really comfortable because I think that changes the perception, and I notice that I get more respect and treated with more equality when I use those pronouns or when I try to take my quote-unquote femininity out of the conversation. I am trying to shine a light in the only way I feel like my gifts right now allow me to do so. I dance and then I film it. That has been a big source of joy for me, even before the quarantine, but especially now. I get super driven by all these amazing artists and dancers I see on social media. So I'll either choreograph something or I'll learn a dance that another choreographer has taught, and I'll film it. I'll put my own spin on it, do it with costumes or different camera angles, and then edit it. I'm so goofy. Dancing and making my fun, silly little videos, I'm able to connect so many people. People I've known from my past or make new connections. It brings me so much joy when people said, this just made me smile so much. So in my very small way, that is how I'm trying to bring meaning to my life and to everyone's life.
Palantonio continues to speak up, change the game, and bring joy to her community through the art of singing, dancing, and acting.
100 years ago, American women won the right to vote. I'm Marty Moscoen. This is Women 100, a series celebrating women who made possible a century of progress. Women like Alva Belmont, who used her wealth to support the women's suffrage movement in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. Born in Alabama in 1853, her father was a cotton merchant and her mother the daughter of a U.S. congressman. Alva Belmont founded the Political Equality League to bring working-class immigrant and African-American women into a movement dominated by middle-class whites. With Alice Paul, she formed the National Women's Party in 1916 and organized the very first picketing in front of the White House. Produced by WHYY with Drexel University. For more information, go to whyy.org/women100.
That's our show for this week. Thanks to Tina Rennick for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1621.